Oh, hey, welcome everyone. We are totally ready and prepared to do this show. This is the Bloody Elbow Vivisection on World Series of Fighting 16. And you know what? This, like, shit is just all over the place this week. We, you know, if you've been watching and, you know, following along with the Bloody Elbow video crew, pretty much all of us have been on a constant cycle of production here, and it's getting a bit wearing down. So now, like, actually getting to the cards and talking about the cards, I'm just like, what the fuck is this? Is this a sport or people fighting? I don't even know. So on that note, we're here to bring you World Series of Fighting 16, which I am amazed to announce, may not be, oh, I'm making this hand gesture, sorry, it's off to the wrong side. Amazed to announce, may not be the last World Series of Fighting card, which I think a lot of people kind of expected it would be, but they have announced another card, World Series of Fighting 17, for next month in mid-January, and it's supposed to be Shields versus Foster, and is scheduled for Las Vegas, January 17th. So are you surprised? I'm joined by Victor Rodriguez, as always, for these World Series of Things. It's the World Series of Things, folks. World Series of Things. Joined by Victor Rodriguez. Vic, are you surprised to hear that World Series of Fighting has another event planned? Stop laughing. We're professionals. Oh, wow.
What an amazing day this will turn out to be. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm the guy with the beard, and we're here to talk some violence with the goofus and gallant of MMA analysis. And now I can't even tell who's the goofus. It's usually me. But that's fine. Don't worry, kids. Don't worry. We'll sort this thing out eventually. Okay, so I was a little surprised to hear about the Foster Shields thing happening. They're planning on having it at the Hard Rock, which is actually good that they're, you know, announcing this with about a month or so to go. This event, they didn't have a venue until what would be considered fairly close to what's considered reasonable in the sport. In fact, they had gone for a while without even announcing where it was going to be. But they had that sorted out. I'm actually excited. I want this to continue. And it's like I've said many times before, I would like for this organization to succeed. But it's one of these things where they're chugging along despite themselves and not because of their better efforts. And that's where it becomes a bit of a shame. This is a bit of a thing where this organization, you'd think at least the fighters and staff would deserve better. But it's just amazing how, with these aspirations of being a grander league or an A-league, as the whole La Liga de Aziz thing went, you still end up with a lot of these sort of amateur mistakes. But it seems like they might be fixing it. This card appears to be evidence of it, and having an event at the Hard Rock with Jake Shields at the top seems like a little bit more evidence that they might be fixing some things at least. So, hey, who knows? This could be good.
Yeah, I have to say one thing it looks like they're doing, I'm not sure on this, and it's not, I just was looking around and it doesn't appear to be anything official, but they appear to be taking a page out of the old Strikeforce book and actually booking a lower promotion as their undercard. Because the lower half of this card is basically entirely West Coast fighting. Like,
yeah, I had noticed that there were a lot of these guys that were veterans of either West Coast or, I mean, these guys are mostly, it's like NorCal versus the world. You have a series of gyms out of Northern California and the Bay Area, and some from the Reno area, interestingly enough. A couple of fighters that have dabbled a bit in the Utah-Colorado scene. So that's probably another smart thing. It's sort of what we've seen before, and as we've mentioned many times when it comes to the Bellator model or the Strikeforce model, where they'll show up and they'll pick up some guys from the regional scene and from the surrounding areas of the venue that they're going to be at or the city that they're going to be at. And from there, they start to fill up the undercard. But in this case, if you're going to do something like that, it pays greatly to do it in a place or in a region that's as rich in talent as the Northern California area. That's not a bad thing. This is actually one of those things where that model has paid off really well, at least on paper so far.
Yeah, I mean,
so,
I would say it's actually, and I guess, yeah, that Bellator has done some of that, when, especially when they do, like, the North American, it's the NAAFS, I can't remember what that all stands for right now. It's where Stipe Miocic came up through. Bellator has booked, like, undercards that were basically entirely an NAAFS card. But I am thinking more, like, because a lot of times what Bellator will do is they'll just, like, scrape the bottom of anybody local that has, like, a 10-12 record. Hey, let's get him on this card. He's got some fans, and put it together. But this actually feels like, you know, they've taken a small sort of successful regional building block organization, and they're just putting on, like, a night of champions for them. You know, you've got, like, guys, I think it's like, you know, Christian Espinoza is one of their flyweight champ, and Chris Avila is like their featherweight champ, and, you know, just like everyone out of this little promotion that has any name value or any success at all, and they're all populating this card, and it makes for what looks like it could be a really fun and even potentially prospect-heavy undercard.
Yeah, it does, and you know, it's funny too, because it seems to be somewhat of a, what I like to consider, an incestuous card. As you look at how many guys are on this card that have opponents in common, how many of these guys have either fought each other or have maybe one or two or even three opponents in common? That's actually it does make for a bit of an interesting experiment, but it seems to be a reasonable one, and I really think that's a very, very solid positive for them. So yeah.
Yeah, it's a surprisingly good step forward, and it may be a thing where, like, as they're obviously shucking talent left and right as at the top of their promotion, this may be a case where they're no longer going to be, you know, it makes me wonder if they're going to actually keep any of these guys around at the bottom, win or lose, or whether this is actually just a West Coast fighting card and all these guys will be kicking around their local regional scene after this, and not, you know, and maybe back on a World Series of Fighting card sometime in the future, like if they can pick up one or two really good guys. But for the most part, like, I get the feeling this is not, like, the bottom half of this, these guys won't be like World Series of Fighting products.
No, they're not really in the business of signing anyone lately. That's the thing. In fact, if anything, they've had some tiffs with some fighters. We talked last time about how the release of their former welterweight champion, Steve Carl. Now, lately, we found out that they had another release after their dispute, that they had a problem with Cody Bollinger and that whole ugly mess. I mean, that was even, if anything, that's probably worse than the whole Steve Carl thing. One thing is not giving someone a fight. Another thing is telling someone, well, hey, listen, we know that for your health you're trying not to cut down to 135. You're trying to do something different. But if you fight our 135 champion, we can get you paid. Otherwise, we probably can't get you a fight until next year. And obviously, this is a pay-to-play business, you know. I should say play-for-pay. If you don't fight, you do not get paid. What was the guy going to do? You know, he goes in there, and then they had that whole mess of whether or not it was going to be a non-title match, if it was going to be for the title, how much he was going to get paid. The whole thing was an ugly mess. They ended up cutting him or allowing him, releasing him from his contract. So, yeah, I mean, you know, they're sort of, when someone leaves the organization, it's ugly, it's messy, and it's public much more than it should be. I wonder how much longer Jacob Volkman gets to stay around, because that's another guy who, I don't know if they've released him yet. He was making some noise. He hasn't fought for them in a while. So
yeah,
I don't think they're picking anyone up.
It definitely feels like a car that, as it's driving down the road, parts are kind of rattling off of it. But you know, they've at least it appears hitched a rather nice trailer to it right now, and that is. That's making me excited for this single card, and
yeah.
I don't know.
Hopefully, we can. I'm sorry.
It's fine. I don't know if we can be. You know, I don't know if the next one will look like it at all or not. But
No, this is on again on paper. This looks like a really solid card, very much worth watching, and I'm very happy to see some of the matchups that they've done. Again, to their credit, they've put together some of these fights that you know from some of the guys on the lower end of the card. Stylistically, they seem to go rather well, and it looks like it's going to be not only entertaining but something that can help some of these fighters in their careers. Also, at the top of the card, you've got the usual sort of I'm not even sure what label to put on it, but it really is a thing where you start wondering, okay, where do these guys go from here? And we'll get to that when we reach the top of the card in terms of the main event and the co-main event, which is going scarily under the radar. But it's good to see that they're losing some of the excess baggage in terms of some of the drama, you know, Rasefo accusing XFC of forging paperwork and all that stuff. And we can focus, hopefully, just on the action here and the fighters, which is where it needs to be.
Yeah. So first up on the docket, we've got a couple fighters making their debut at 0-0, and it's always nice when you can see two fighters making their debut, and there's actually, like, some tape on these guys. There are people talking about them a little bit. Like, this is what you hope for when you see a major promotion, and, you know, for whether we like it or not, World Series of Fighting is still a reasonably major promotion. If they're going to be signing guys at 0-0, these are the kind of guys you want to see. Justin Durham was a collegiate wrestler for UC Bakersfield, which I actually think is where my dad went to college, weirdly. Dylan Blakesley apparently has a background in Taekwondo. Durham is undefeated as an amateur. Blakesley, I think, is like 4-1. What do you know? What else do you know about these two?
All right. Well, Blakesley, I only show him as being 1-0 as an amateur, unless there's some problem with my source. I could be wrong about that, but that's what I'm showing here. Pretty solid. Well, his takedown defense is a bit questionable. He is composed, and he seems to be much more complete striker of these two. But there's a lot of question marks on this, although I am interested in seeing what he can do from here. Durham, on the other hand, he's 5-0 as an amateur, and as you mentioned, obviously pro debut for both of them. And he's currently on a 5-win streak. All of his wins have been finishes, with 4 of them going to strikes, 1 of them being a submission. Very strong, very explosive guy, very fast. And he loves his hammer punches. I mean, he just, you know, I don't really want to call it swing and cling in his case, because he doesn't really do so much swinging. He does sort of set up a good clinch and then start working his takedowns from there. Doesn't disguise much of what he does, but he's got room to grow. And doesn't seem to favor submissions much. He'll take it if it's there, but he really does like going for the ground strikes. And so we'll see how Blakesley deals with that.
Yeah, he's a wrestling prospect. And a wrestling prospect early in their career, I mean, at 0-0 in their career, you can't ask for much more than a guy who's going to shoot in for a takedown and try for work top control.
Like, and a guy who's willing to learn.
Yeah. Blakesley is 4-1. MixedMartialArts.com does a really good job tracking amateur records. So his amateur record is 4-1 with 2 TKOs, 2 decisions, or no, 1 TKO, 2 decisions, a submission, and a TKO loss. So it's a fight that I'm definitely, you know, it's a good prospect fight. It's a fight I expect Durham to win. I think he should be the favorite just because you get a young guy with that wrestling background and who has his style where he's really going to come in and work his wrestling. He should be winning a fight like that. Next up we have Joseph Morales and Christian Espinoza. Morales, I believe, is another amateur wrestler. I think he only wrestled at the high school level. I couldn't find anything collegiate for him. And Espinoza is the West Coast Fighting amateur flyweight champion, I believe. So can you tell me about this matchup?
All right. Well, Morales appears to be training out of Team Alpha Male, which, you know, if he was not a good wrestler, they probably wouldn't take him in. 3-0, and he's got one draw. All of his wins are by submission, actually, and this is his pro debut. Very, very aggressive wrestler. He's got a very solid top game. It's hard to get the guy off. He knows how to move. He's got his positioning where it needs to be for the situation. And once something isn't working, he's willing to be able to make the to be fluid and be able to make the adjustments necessary to get something better working. He's very dynamic. He's very fast, and he's also a wrestler who's able to work off his back pretty well. In Espinoza, you got a guy who I show here who's 6-0 as an amateur with two TKOs and one submission. 2-0 as a pro thus far with one of them being a TKO. His only notable opposition that I could find was Antonio McKee Jr., who he beat by knockout. And we'll be seeing more of the family McKee in a bit. He's got a very strong counter game. Very, very powerful. His timing seems to be a bit off with his strikes, but he's always looking to draw his opponent in. And again, this, if it stays standing, it's pretty much a toss up. But if it goes, if it turns into a fun grappling match, I think we're going to be in for a lot of fun.
Yeah, I would favor Morales again just because of the background and the camp. But Espinoza seems like a really game grappler and striker, and it's the kind of fighter that could easily give a debuting fighter a loss, like Morales, who really is, you know, who's a good, decent grappler, but is really like, you know, wrestle, grapple. A little predictable. Espinoza might be, you know, it's a fight he could win, but it's a good grab. And once again, you know, you're talking about really young fighters early in their careers. These are the kind of fighters you want pop. Yes, that's very cute.
She's a better analyst than I am. I love this. She's more qualified than I am.
So next up, we got Chris Avila versus Jason Powell. And I think if you looked at Chris Avila and watched even one of his fights, you would say Cesar Gracie Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah, this is so true.
Yeah.
It's funny because I'm sorry, but his Twitter page actually, when instead of posting a website of his own, which he appears to not have, he puts NathanDiaz.com, which is interesting because of how much he looks like Nate Diaz as he fights with everything he's got. I'm sorry.
It's so prototypical. I watched like one bout. And he's stalking around, trying to box his opponent, putting his arms out, and it's just like, he's a Cesar Gracie fighter, right? And you go look at his page, and it's just like, he totally is.
Oh, it's a beautiful thing to watch, man. It's beautiful, I tell you.
It is. Mm. Now, and on the other side, Powell looks like a kind of a powerhouse. I mean, he looks like a pretty physically imposing dude. And, you know, maybe not the most complete game apart from that. Or, like, the most complicated game, but a really imposing athlete when you compare him to somebody like Avila.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because that is something that I noticed. He seems to use more of his athleticism instead. He seems to naturally go to that towards either working his way out of certain situations or trying to get his takedowns or things of that nature. It's like he always relies more on his athleticism, actually getting him to where he needs to be. That said, he is 2-0 as an amateur with both of those being decision wins and 1-1 as a pro thus far. One submission win and one submission loss. Doesn't really say much for a guy who's young in his budding career, so, you know, we'll see what happens with him. Very good with his sprawls, very strong in the clinch as well, and he's got some crazy scrambles. He ends up in these situations that somehow he seems to do well when the situation gets chaotic. Not very conventional in terms of a guard passing game, and his striking I haven't seen that much of. Interestingly enough, he's also got a loss to Sinjin Smith, who's further up on the card, and we'll be talking about later. But in terms of Avila, he's 1-1, both of those fights being decisions. Very wild swings. He's all over the place, this guy. I mean, you know, he seems to do his best work off his back. And he seems to enjoy just doing that whole sort of boxing jiu-jitsu aggro game. Not sure how that's going to work. His timing doesn't look as sharp as someone who would want to get away with that style might. It might serve him for now, though.
Yeah, I think Powell's going to win. I would give him the edge here just because of his that clinch offense he has looks really powerful and really solid and like something he's worked on. And I mean, the thing with that Cesar Gracie jiu-jitsu style is like if you are not like the perfectly attuned athlete for that style, it really doesn't like it's not a great way to win fights consistently.
No, you need to have there's a degree of things that you need to gauge in your opponent probably. There's certain ways that you have to set things up and certain other things that you have to be very prepared for. That it's really not a one-size-fits-all thing. And I mean, it might work out for the guy. He's still expanding his skill set. You don't know. But he would need to make some adjustments for him to continue being successful.
Yeah. Next up, we've got another featherweight bout. Eric Sanchez, Dre Mitchell. Watching a little, you know, Sanchez is another Team Alpha Male fighter, which, like, that does mean something, but it means less when you consider how much of, like, a massive infrastructure camp Team Alpha Male runs now. Like, you know, Faber has, like, you know, like, a whole, like, housing development for Team Alpha Male guys to come live at while they train at his gym. And, you know, he's running the Team Alpha Male, the Team Alpha Male slum sort of, like, thing.
Yeah, it's not as pronounced as maybe Noble Niao having satellite schools in various locations or something like that, but it's gotten pretty big. And it's turned into something else. It's not on the level of maybe American Top Team or something like that, but yeah, I mean, look, you're still an alpha male guy, you know, you still have a pretty solid pedigree, no shame there, but it's not all of them are going to be Benavidez. Not all of them are going to be Faber. And a lot of these guys are coming up in the game too.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I think watching a little tape on them, I think I would give the edge here to Dre Mitchell even with his 1-2 record. He looks like a fighter who has a much more like win focused style at the moment. I mean, he shoots well, he gets in and works top control well. He may not, you know, be the most technically sound fighter in any one area, but Sanchez just strikes me a little bit as sort of I didn't see anything really impressive out of him watching him fight.
Yeah, well, I mean, he seems to have pretty good movement, and he does have a great top game. He mixes up his striking, and he's pretty fast as he does it. Dre Mitchell, interestingly enough, I did see him as 1-2. I also saw him as 2-2. For some reason, somewhere he's listed as with 1 KO and 1 submission win with 2 decision losses. I'm not sure which of those to go with. However, he is 1-0 as an amateur with a finish due to strikes. Very strong, excellent takedown defense. He's pretty much a guy who likes to work from the clinch in terms of taking guys down and then working from there with relentless top striking and a varied kind of a suffocating game at that point. You know, he really knows when to pour on the pressure and when to ease back. So that's Sanchez is going to be in for a handful right there.
Yeah. All right, now speaking of Cesar Gracie Jiu-Jitsu guys and how that style doesn't necessarily work for everyone, a man that is a lot of fun to watch and always has been, but has been on a hell of a cold streak lately, David Tarzan Douglas.
Yeah.
He looked like such a fun prospect rising up through the ranks of Strikeforce and Elite XC. Yeah. And then he lost Carlos Fordor back in 2011 and has only fought twice since then, most recently being against Usman Diago. In 2012, and Diagne, back in 2012, and he hasn't fought since, and He's set up against for a really tough fight here against somebody who looks like they're really putting things together in St. John Smith.
Yeah, this is another one of those odd matchups in which, and this happens in every organization, I'd say. You have a guy who there's no telling where he's at in terms of his career, in terms of mentally. Like, this is really, he is at a bit of a crossroads in a sense, but it's a little confusing because he's only 8-5, which may not be the most impressive record in some cases, but he is pretty, he's looked really good in a lot of those wins. He started off back in 2004. He's 32 right now, so, I mean, in fight years, he's pretty much up there, despite the fact that he hasn't fought in, what, 2.5 or almost 3 years now. Have you actually seen the finish to that Diagne fight?
I have not, no.
Okay, it was, I mean, you could make the argument that it was probably an early stoppage, but it was pretty ugly. It was one of those head kicks that just...
Yeah.
I'm not really sure where that's going. However, he did have a hell of a run fighting for Show XC and Strikeforce. He ended up fighting Malapet somehow. I don't know how that happened, but he ended up winning. Although, impressive as that may be, it was mostly because he was using his ground game against a guy who's known as a Muay Thai superstar. So, you know, not to diminish his win, but again, certain factors have to be considered. Somewhat basic boxing, pretty decent wrestler, very, very dogged, very determined, and puts on a hell of a pace on these guys. He's got great timing, however, when he strikes. Interestingly enough, some of his losses, there's no real shame in them. I mean, he's lost to, let's see, Jeff Curran, who we fought way back in the IFC, on a card that was headlined by Roxanne Modafferi, no less. So that's something to consider. Justin Wilcox and Strikeforce.
Why is that something to consider?
Well, no, because of it's the longevity thing. I mean, these are people who started off, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like...
You got to explain to me the connection of why Roxanne Modafferi headlining a card says good things.
Well, she headlined a card damn near 9 years ago, and look, she's turning stuff around today. So that's kind of, you know.
All right.
That's pretty good. And as you mentioned, the fight against Carlos Fordor, the brother of one Phoenix Jones, defender of the night.
Anyway, we should be St. John Smith. David Douglas has been around. He's a good athlete. He's a fun fighter. He does not have a functional game. St. John Smith has a really fun sort of traditional martial arts, high output kickboxing style. You know, a bit of a sort of Wonder Boy thing going on.
Oh, don't mention Wonder Boy. But, oh, wait till Lucas hears this.
Yeah, but I mean, at this level, like it, you know, I looked at this, like 8-5, 2-0. St. John Smith better be really pretty good, otherwise Douglas could easily win this fight. But I gotta think Smith's gonna win it.
Well, here's my problem with this right now. It's the fact that Smith is he's a little too hittable for my liking. And I'm not sure how that's going to work against a guy like Douglas. However, he loves working his knees from the clinch. There was a fight he had against a guy named Mario Soto that was pretty damn exciting. He's crafty, and he's got some pretty solid fight IQ. But if it stays standing, he very well might get caught, and he might, you know, he's hard to put away. But I don't know. It makes me a little uncomfortable to see that right there.
All right. Well, let's try to step this up because we spent a lot of time talking about these guys. Okay, Martin Sano, Dominic Waters. Sano looks like a pretty decent physical sort of fighter, very much a brawler. Waters is a little bit more of a sort of get inside and try and work for a takedown and, you know, still very much a scrappy fighter. This looks like it's going to be kind of a, you know, a slug-it-out brawl. I expect Waters to maybe look for the takedowns a little more. Not sure who's going to win it. You got any one side or another you're going to?
I'm not really sure. I mean, Sano trains or used to train out of Wanderlei Silva's gym. He's a counterpuncher who hits really, really hard. And he does have one submission win to his name. Dominic Waters, he's 6-2, all pro. He's got a decision loss to Ron Kessler. No shame there. He's coming off a loss. He's fighting this weekend, and somehow he's still booked already for a January 9th event that Bama USA is putting on. I'm not sure how that happens, but that's the sport, ladies and gentlemen. This is what we're dealing with. Somewhat basic wrestling, and he relies a lot on his athleticism, which may serve him well. And he likes throwing a lot of flashy strikes. If he gets careless, Sino might be able to put him to sleep. However, if Waters implements his takedown game or his clinch game and is able to tire him out and work from there, it could also work well in his favor.
Yeah. All right, Justin Bazeman, David Doughty Mitchell. We've got a Bellator vet versus a UFC vet for the title of the scrappiest former top-tier fighter or top like promotional level fighter. I got to go with Mitchell all the way. They have him Tapology has him listed now as training out of Team Alpha Male, no longer and NorCal Fighting Alliance doesn't even exist anymore, I don't think. But I got to think Mitchell all the way. He's one of those guys who doesn't quite have the game for the UFC or the athleticism for the UFC, but has a really well-crafted, complete MMA game that just dominates on the regional level.
One thing to note here is that Mitchell has fought, and he's fought much better opposition. That's not a knock on Bazeman, obviously, but, I mean, you look at some of the guys he got. He's 16-4 with 11 submissions as a pro. Obviously, he's fought, Tachi Palace. He's fought in CCFC. He's fought in the UFC. He beat War Machine back when that was a big deal. He beat Bobby Green, actually, I believe it was by submission at one point. He ended up fighting a bunch of guys in the UFC that really were probably a bit too much too soon. He ended up losing to guys like TJ Waldberg, Paulo Thiago, Mike Pierce, Jan Cabral. He seems to have a knack for really getting himself in very, very bad positions and then magically just pulling something out of his Felix the Cat bag and just coming out of it. And his stand-up may be a bit basic, but he's just really, really good at securing the clinch and then working his game from there. And then he just snatches on. He just snatches a limb, and it's very methodical how his submission game comes along. I'm envious of this man's submission game. Bazeman, though, I'm sorry, you were saying?
No, I was just gonna say that. Yes. So.
Yeah.
Moving forward. Is there a reason that Bazeman should win this fight?
Well, I don't know. I mean, look, here's a guy who's got somewhat. I mean, his striking is also very basic. His defense is probably – actually, it's a little better than basic, but his defense isn't where it needs to be. He stands a lot more upright, and he doesn't tuck in his chin as much, which is why he gets hit with some shots that, that are pretty harsh. Also very good with scrambles. I think Mitchell's grappling is way too technical. I don't see many avenues for Bazeman to win.
All right. That's what I want to hear. Plain and simple, the skinny. We're lagging here. Okay, Dave Huckabutt, J.R. Lugo. I can't say I care about this fight. It's the exact kind of heavyweight fight that regional MMA specializes in. Huckabutt might win it. He's an exceptionally old dog in the hunt at this point, though. Lugo is also the kind of not very tall, not very in shape heavyweight that is really populates the lower ranks ubiquitously and never does terribly well beyond the regional level. So I can't care about this fight. I can't pick who's going to win it. Do you have any strong, quick feelings?
Oh, I got feelings, all right. Here's the problem. I don't know who Dave Huckabee is going to fight because some websites, including World Series of Fighting, still had him as fighting C.J. Levesque. I'm not certain if he's fighting C.J. Levesque or J.R. Lugo. Either way, it's going to be a hell of a lot of fun. Much more fun if he fights Lugo, and I'll tell you why. C.J. Levesque is 8-7. He has losses to guys like Josh Appelt and then Javier Ayala, who are both in Bellator now. He did win against Warpath Villarreal, which, that's something, but he fights ugly. I mean, like, death ugly. It's a lot of clinches, a lot of heavy, up against the cage. It's not cute to look at. It's not aesthetically pleasing. However, if he fights Lugo, this is amazing. This guy, this is where shit gets crazy. This is where, when people wonder if the world that we live in is actually a simulation, I'm inclined to think that they might be onto something. Here's a guy who, his nickname is Mr. Incredible, okay? He has his own team. He's 5-1 with one no contest due on IPO. He actually already fought and beat C.J. Levesque, right? So there's that. He ended up beating a guy who's 2-2. He's a white guy who's 260 pounds who goes by the name of Tyler Perry. This is the part where I wonder if my dad is going to come through that door and punch me in my fucking head until it turns black, because I just said that out loud. I mean, I don't know where to go with this whole thing. This is just...
Well, let's assume he's fighting J.R. Lugo. I mean...
Let's assume he is. That's still pretty... That is some pretty... You have to... This looks made up. This doesn't look real, you know? God, wait,
all right,
how is this supposed
right.
to work?
You are amazed by things that I cannot be amazed by. I envy you here.
It's morbid. It's morbid. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Hakuba he doesn't have the best opposition. He did just lose to Erokin, who just got, I believe he just got signed by the UFC.
Yes.
I would probably give Lugo the advantage here because of how much harder he hits, and he does seem to be a bit faster. Youth will certainly help him out as well.
All right. That's what I want to know. Luis mm-hmm. Gonzalez, Justin Buchholz. Buchholz has been out of MMA for a little while now, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. His last fight was, well, it's only about a year. It's not that long. But, you know, he's a guy who was in the UFC for a couple years, from 2008 to 2010. Yeah. And... didn't do particularly well there, has been off and on good and bad since then, kind of, you know, most recently losing to Clay Collard, who's now, we have seen the, you know, what that means in the UFC right now. That means that he's being overwhelmed by an incredibly sloppy volume fighter with a really good chin. He's taking on, you know, an opponent here in Luis Gonzalez, who just came out and got head kicked to death by Luis Palomino. Mm. Or was that a head kick, or was that?
I think it was a flying. No,
a flying knee.
It was a punch. Oh, Christ. Yeah, I don't. You know what? I don't exactly remember how that finish went. I feel a little embarrassed right now.
Okay. So now that we're not Palomino, Luis Gonzalez. Now I have to look this up because I was sure, and then now I'm not.
No, I got it right here. Actually, it's as soon as this thing decides to help me out here and open.
He lost the punch. So it was a flying knee. Okay. It was a knee. Okay. So he got kneed to death by Luis Palomino most recently. I still got a push that Luis Gonzalez is probably going to win here. He's the younger, fresher fighter on the rise. Buchholz is kind of an old dog trying to learn new tricks. Mm-hmm. But any reason that you would pick Buchholz here?
Well, maybe that break will serve him well. Despite being older, he does still have a bunch of submission wins. He has fought better opposition despite losing to them. And, you know, he's fearless when it comes to his striking. He's not perhaps as tentative as Gonzalez is, who strikes just as a setup to go for a takedown. He's somewhat stagnant in his movement, although he is solid in the clinch. So I'm not sure how that's going to work for him. However, Gonzalez, he lost to Palomino. There's no shame in that whatsoever. He ended up beating Justin Bazeman. He also has a win over Antonio McKee. Very, very solid pressure. He's also just a lot of forward movement and very, very good wrestling. Buchholz, being an alpha male product, will probably be well-suited to deal with it, but I'm not sure what else he can do from there. So we might end up seeing something that'll be an ugly decision, but it seems to me like this would go in Gonzalez's favor.
Yeah, that's got to be my feeling. All right, next up, Josh Berkovic, and Brenson Hansen. This is also, like I say, this, you know, World Series of Fighting is getting some really good prospects here. Berkovic was an NCAA wrestler. Do you know, I don't know what his status there was. I believe he was a pretty accomplished one. For Wisconsin, and he now fights out of the scrap pack with Gilbert Melendez. And he's getting a decent opponent in Brinson Hansen, but I got to think it's one that's sort of set up for, you know, somebody set up for him to beat.
I'm looking at this as more of a test. I mean, if he wins, great, but I don't think it's one of those things that will, you know, well, let's put him in there with Brinson so he can beat him. Yeah, it seems to be more like, well, let's see where this kid's at now. Pretty much where you want to be. This kid's only, Berkovic is only 5-0 right now. Still young in his fighting career. And, you know, he beat one of his more recent wins was Anthony Avila, who was 12-2 when they fought, and that was his fifth fight. Obviously, some fighters come along a little faster than others, you know, but fine, okay. Berkovic, as you mentioned, very solid wrestling. But he's also really good at finding his position. He's also very aware of where he's at. His submission defense, you know, it's hard for you to be able to even attempt one because of where he is. Very aggressive with his strikes, and he seems to favor them over submissions when it comes to his top control. Now, on the other hand, you got Brinson, who's 6-2, all professional. He's only got one flying knee KO. The rest of them are decisions. And this is his fifth fight in World Series of Fighting with a loss to Freddy Assunção, which is his most notable opponent. Kind of basic with his kickboxing, and I don't know how he's going to deal with the constant pressure that Berkovic brings. I don't know how he's going to handle with his wrestling and what he'll be able to do from there, either getting off his back or working off his back.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean when I say that it's a fight made for Berkovic to win. Not necessarily that Brinson Hansen is a bad opponent, but just that he's not an especially dangerous opponent. He's not a guy, you know, you're not putting him in there against a wrecking machine. You're putting him in there against a reasonably decent rising fighter who has some tools and will be competitive, but not a guy who's going to, like, go out and just pull out submission after submission after submission after submission or be just searching for the knockout with, like, monstrous power striking. He's getting somebody that is competitive but beatable.
And they're comparable records, too. I mean, this is kind of where he should be fighting, where they both should be fighting, guys like this. And this is a good metric to see where they are.
Yeah. All right, next up, this is exciting. I can't not be excited for this. We finally get to see the debut of Shaman Moraes in World Series of Fighting. He's been off doing Muay Thai in Thailand because World Series of Fighting couldn't afford to actually get him a fight. And they now finally have. And I know you think you've got some reservations, but I think this looks like a showcase bout against somebody who is willing and able, or more than willing, to stand up and try to bang with him in Gabriel Solorio, but does not have the athleticism to compete.
Well, here's what's going to happen. All right, you got Shaman, who is, you know, he came over from Muay Thai. He's been doing MMA for 2 years. 6-0 so far as a professional with a win over UFC, I don't even know what to call him. Let's just say former UFC talent, Pedro Nobre. you may remember him as the guy who faked a foul or a DQ and then acted like it was just no big thing. Even his former boss, Valid Ismail, just shat on him everywhere for that. But here's the thing, 6-0, pretty decent record, but he's been fighting guys whose records have been, and these are very important, 15-14, 6-6, 1-2, and 1-2. This does not say good things. Now, he is fighting a guy who's 11-7 in Gabriel Solorio, who also, he comes, alleged, I think he's still training with AKA. That's a pretty good sign. 6 submission wins. He's got losses to Ian Loveland and to Begbulat Magomedov, Dagestani product. If Solorio gets this to the ground, I really got to wonder how Moraes is going to handle this, even though he is a Team Nogueira product. I'd like to think he's got some jiu-jitsu in there. Obviously, if not, he should not be doing MMA. But I got to wonder if Solorio can come up with the upset here. I really don't know how Moraes, who's used to fighting guys who are tough, but just, they're not very notable either. So I don't feel comfortable making a pick here.
That's the Shaman Moraes. This is, to me, watching tape on Solorio, I mean, yeah, he can kickbox a little, and maybe he's kind of tough, but the athleticism side of it is not there in the same way it is for Moraes. And you know, Moraes then goes over and supplements all that by going out and fighting Muay Thai fights and stuff like that. I mean, it's just not like he's not competitive. And, you know, it's not like Pedro Nobre, you know, as much as we may like to shit on him as much as it may, like, the hallmark of his career may have been that whole thing with him potentially faking getting hit in the back of the head, it's not like Nobre's a bad, like, got a bad record or has been a bad fighter throughout his career. You know,
no, he got to the UFC by being a very solid talent, and I mention him precisely because he's not only the most notable opponent, but because he's a very well-rounded veteran, and that was a very good win for him. So yeah. I mean, if that's the only name that you're gonna have that's got a really good record, it's a great name to have.
I wouldn't read too much into the level of competition, especially when you're talking about going against somebody who's 11-7. And expecting that to be a big step up. I don't see it. But moving along, we have our now co-main event, 145-pound title fight, Rick Glenn, Lance Palmer. This is a great fight. This is looks like a ton of fun. It's not a classic style matchup. That's always a little bit of a bullshit thing thrown around. But it is a sort of, you know, Glenn, when I watch him fight, he's very much a kick-heavy fighter with a decent clinch striking game, a good clinch striking game, and then, like, a scrappy wrestling grappling game that maybe isn't his strength, but he's athletic enough to make it work. And then Lance Palmer is very much the wrestle boxer.
That sounds fairly adequate. Yeah. We're in for a lot of fun here, and it's a shame. It's a shame because, number one, this card is not getting the fanfare or the attention that it should. And number two, these guys are going completely under the radar in an exciting division with two very, very solid talents who can move on to do pretty big things later on. And it really is a bit of a problem. Palmer's 8-1 as a pro. Rick Glenn, 15-2. They both fought some pretty tough guys on the regional end. This is one of those fights where I really wouldn't be able to make a pick, but man, if Palmer gets his way, if he's able to implement his physical skills along with his wrestling, which will be no easy task because Rick Glenn has some pretty solid wrestling as well. He's a Rufus Sport product who they don't play lightly when it comes to their wrestling, and they have a higher, I guess, output of better strikers than most gyms do these days. I'm not sure how this is going to really work. I'm not sure how Palmer would game plan around it. Glenn may have more avenues for victory here.
Yeah, and actually, I guess I should say more specifically that Palmer's more of a wrestle grappler than wrestle boxer, but neither of them are, like, poor, really poor anywhere. Palmer, most notably, is just kind of a little bowling ball of muscle. Like, he's 5'5" at 145 pounds, and it's a pretty legit 145 pounds. I mean, we're not talking about somebody who's like looks like they're not cutting weight for the division. He looks like he's practically, you know, could cut off a limb and still be at 145.
I was starting to think he had fought elsewhere at lightweight. I'm sorry. My mistake.
But he, you know, he, in some ways, it's basically, you know, it's strange seeing him about to fight underneath Husamar Palharas, because that's very much the body type of Lance Palmer. And yeah. I think that Glenn has obviously got, anytime you see a fight, and, you know, even just recently in his loss to Karkanyan, anytime you see a fighter who has that kind of wrestling, grappling, and, you know, there's always a chance that they're going to get caught in something or caught with something. Yeah. It's, you know, Glenn's going to have, he throws a lot of kicks, he kicks hard, he's going to throw up submission attempts, he's going to work well in the clinch. It is a tough fight to bookmark. I mean, I think Palmer's slightly more on, like, that blue chip prospect track, but it's a tough fight, and I'm not sure. I'm leaning Palmer on this, but only very slightly.
Yeah, and I gotta wonder who would actually have the cardio edge here too, because that's another thing that I'm not really certain about. I think Glenn might be able to outlast him if he plays it really smart and is very careful with countering Palmer's game. So that's another thing to look out for there.
It is. The later this fight goes, the more Palmer might become predictable, and the more this fight might turn towards Glenn's favor at that point. It is also just slightly a worry to me, though, the Rufus Sport, like, guard-pulling thing and the comfort of trying to work an active guard. And I do wonder if that would factor in at all, if Glenn would be willing to give up position to try and aggressively attack Palmer, and that might be a mistake. Yeah, finally, we get the fight that I really wonder still to this moment if John Fitch wants it. But we have John Fitch versus Husamar Paulharis, and it's an awesome fight. It's a fun fight. But, I mean, who really wants to fight Husamar Paulharis?
I think John Fitch does. The only problem I'm finding here is his problems with how Paulharis handles himself in terms of the situation with, oh, well, I can't fight because I'm taking care of my mother, or, you know, the situation with his leg lock, what got him ousted from the UFC after a win. Very rarely does that happen. You know, you got to be in one of those sort of like Babalu, David Heath situations, you know, where you take something way too far in your win and you have to go. That said, I don't think John Fitch is necessarily worried about him. Look, think back to the UFC event where Husamar Paulharis took that fight against Alan Belcher. Alan Belcher exclusively and extensively trained to counter those leg locks, started threatening some of his own, and then he just put that dude to sleep. He just punched him in his head until it looked like a California raisin. Okay? There's a difference between being a one-trick pony and being a specialist in something. And Paulharis may be a specialist in leg locks, but it's the way he sets them up and the rest of the submission threats that he can make. And or that he can bring forth. People are forgetting that, like, for example, the fight that he had with Ivan Salivary in the UFC, where he opened some eyes by armbarring a guy whose jiu-jitsu was pretty goddamn solid. So, I mean, Fitch, I'm pretty sure he's going to be training accordingly. He knows what the game is. Everybody knows what Paulharis' main objective is going to be. Fitch has fought better opposition. Fitch has been in longer fights. He has fought strong guys as well. I don't see why. I mean, if it were anybody else, I mean, if it were perhaps Steve Carl, you know, like as that fight went, yeah, you know, he'd be a little worried. But Fitch has nothing to worry about here in that sense. He has various avenues for winning this fight. And if he keeps the top pressure heavy, he's going to run away with this. I don't know if Paulharis is going to be able to counter that.
Yeah, I got to say, I feel, and I feel bad because I don't, you know, this is one of those things that one doesn't want to have to do, like, to do this because it feels a little, I don't know, fatalist. But I've got to kind of put Fitch on that veteran competitor circuit a little at this point in his career. Like, you know, I mean, he's been fighting since 2002 consistently. And
yeah, he has.
You don't last forever. You just don't. And you look at, you know, his wins, that, you know, that win over Eric Silva was pretty amazing lately. But otherwise, you've got a win over Marcelo Alfaya, who has been fighting since 2002, and a win over Dennis Hallman, who has been fighting since the dawn of time. And, you know, losses to Josh Berkman, Damian Maia, Johnny Hendricks, and a draw to BJ Penn, as weird a draw as that was. And, I, you know, Paulharis is still, he really only started fighting seriously and with any regularity in 2006. And he's, you know, right at maybe the tail end of his time as a top competitive fighter, but I think he's still there. And I don't think that Fitch has the competitive tools at this point to deal with somebody at that stage in their career. Somebody who has competed at as high a level as Paul Harris has. Maybe if Paul Harris had been like a regional journeyman, something like that. But Paul Harris is still a monster. He's still a beast of a fighter.
He still is, certainly. And, you know, look, as tough, I mean, Marcelo Arfaya is a very tough guy that a lot of people were selling short. He did give Fitch a more competitive fight than many people expected, although whether or not that is a whether or not that speaks to Alfaya's talents as a fighter being underrated or Fitch perhaps being on some sort of decline, that's, you know, you could argue either side. Dennis Hallman, somewhat of a veteran too, you know, probably not someone that should have been beating John Fitch anyway, although he's still a hell of a guy in the cage. But at the same time, again, I just feel he's fought better guys. He's been in more and tougher situations, and he's persevered. I don't see how not to say that Pajares can't win. I just really think that he's not only does he have more avenues to win, he's got a better probability of winning. So I don't think he's as done as a lot of people think he is, and I really think perhaps he might not make it to the UFC again. Maybe that's not something he wants to begin with, but you know he's still a top guy. I still think he's at least top 20. And you know Pajares, obviously he is a hell of a guy. He's a wrecking ball, and you know he's not. This is going to be a very stiff test to see what
both
of these guys
because are. I care about you, and I don't like to see your dreams shattered. I hope you're right. Let me put it this way. I wish that having fought better guys and persevered in tougher situations meant more on a matchup-to-matchup basis. I wish that was more as important as it feels like it should be, because I think a lot of times people tend to get caught up in that as like, you know, it's like the Shogun OSP thing. It's like, well, Shogun's fought way better guys.
Yeah, but that's different, though. I mean, the way Shogun loses and the way John Fitch loses, I mean, it's a very different thing. And
I know it is. But I'm just saying, you know? Keep that in your mind. Remember that. Because, it comes into play more often than you want it to.
Yeah, I guess.
It happens a lot more than I think people want to admit that a fighter who should, you know, Mike Brown, Steven Seiler. That's like the classic situation, you know.
Mm. Or Miles Jury Takanori Gomi, maybe.
Yeah, Miles Jury Takanori Gomi.
Yeah.
But like these things, but Steven Seiler thing is a great example because Steven Seiler's not even in the UFC anymore. Like Mike Brown could probably get a fight in the UFC next week if he wanted to, you know. Mm. From his semi-retirement, if he came back, he's still under contract. I think, you know, they'd give him another fight. Yeah, but Steven Seiler's been cut. And, you know, just because Brown has been a better fighter longer does not mean that he beats the young guy or the guy on the rise, the guy still in his prime. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I see Fitch Pajares. Maybe it doesn't work that way. It'd be fun to see Fitch get another big win. I've always been a huge Husamar Pajares fan. I don't even care how he conducts himself. But anyway,
I gotta ask you one quick question though. What was the first time or what was the first incident in his behavior that made you realize, oh shit, I think this guy's got problems? What was the first moment for you that really got that?
Oh, it's probably the Tomas Drawl. Win way back in 2010, but I mean he's one of those fighters that, like, you know, obviously he's a dirty fighter. In, you know, maybe not to the degree I think that a lot of people think he is, but you know, if we're talking about this idea that there are different types of dirty fighters, Husamar Pajares is the guy who sees and takes opportunities without thinking about what they are and what he needs to be doing in that moment, and just is totally like on autopilot. That's the kind of dirty fighter he is. You know, he's the guy that, you know, it's like Melvin Guiard kneeing Ross Pearson in the head when Ross Pearson was on his knees. Like, you don't actually think that Melvin Guillard was like, oh, he's down, fuck that guy, I'm going to knee him in the head right now. He's just like, oh, there's the open knee, there's the open knee, I'm taking it, hit him, oh, shit. Like, that's more that track. It's like you see the opportunity and your body takes the opportunity before your brain can even catch up and tell you, whoa, dude, you shouldn't be doing that. And Huzamal Parhar seems the same way, where it's like, oh, there's the heel hook, I've got the heel hook, I'm taking the heel hook, and... Oh, shit. Yeah, that, like, he was tapping. Yeah. You know, like, he's... Some guys are just like that, and I don't, you know... I think that it doesn't, you know, it's not a good thing, but it's also one of the things, like, you can't really fix it. It's not dirty fighting in the way of, like, an attitude thing or something like that. It's just you're fighting in the moment, and your body is running way ahead of your brain.
You're not a blatant cheater. You're just someone who, you know, you find you're not, as you mentioned, your body's going so much further ahead of your mind that you go, oh, wait, that's right. That's illegal. I shouldn't do that. Or
Later on, you're like, oh, yeah, no, of course I didn't mean to do that. I wasn't trying to hurt him. I just was
So fighting. Let me get this straight. The fight against, what was it, Dan Miller, I think it was, where he hit the guy, he thought he was out, and then he jumped up on the cage. That didn't do it for you? It was a Joel fight?
Well, that was a much more blatant checked out thing, but that's like a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Like, he hit him, and then he's like, "Yes, I won. Run off!" And like, then his brain's kicking in, like, "No, you didn't. You need to get back in there and like keep fighting this fight."
Herb Dean putting his hands on his hips, going, "If you don't get the fuck down from that cage, I swear."
All right, so. That's why I still love Huzamal Parhar and can forgive him all his ills, is because I don't think they're evilly intentioned. But on that note, I think we've gone up and down the World Series of Fighting 16 card. We had to speed it up in the middle there because there are prospects at the bottom of this card I'm really interested in. I'm interested in Justin Durham. I'm interested in Joseph Morales. I'm interested in... Sinjin Smith and in, you know, some of those guys down there. And then there's kind of a middle section that's like, some fighters that could be okay, who knows. And then the top of this card is fun again. You got Josh Berkovich, you've got Shaman Moraes, you've got Lance Palmer and Rick Glenn, and then you got the old dogs at the top. It's just a fun card top to bottom. And even on a huge weekend of fights, it's a card that deserves attention.
Yes, indeed.
So, from Vic's cat and me, I can hold my dog up, but she's fast asleep, so I'm not going to.
Don't do it. Don't do it. No.
You know, if you like this video, give it a like over on YouTube. Thumbs up. Follow follow MMANation.com. That's MMANation.com. It's ridiculous, I know, but whatever. It works somehow. Find us on Bloody Elbow. You can find me at TheZane Simon on Twitter. Vic at Vic M. Rodriguez on Twitter. And we've got another couple of vivisections. I believe tomorrow there were some last-minute shit fell apart kind of problems. So the UFC vivisections, I believe, will be happening tomorrow morning. For everybody wondering why we're doing this now and not then. Anyway, thanks everyone for tuning in. Thanks, Vic, for tuning in. And we'll see you all soon.